Hi there, and welcome to episode 6 of Hogfish Resonance. In this episode, you'll hear my conversation with theater artist Billy Bustamante. Billy is a New York City-based performer, director, and choreographer. He is also the co-founder of Broadway Barkada, which started in 2009 as a small group of Filipino performers, and in the decade plus since has turned into an organization comprised of nearly 100 active members dedicated to bringing the Filipino experience to a diverse audience. Billy is a faculty member at Jen Waldman Studio, a training center for Broadway actors, and he also runs a successful photography business, Billy B. Photography. Here's a clip of Billy singing in Broadway Barkada's So This Is Love, An Evening of Love Songs, performed at the Cutting Room in New York City.
There is one thing that's eternal that cannot be torn apart. There is one thing that remains forever true. Past the thinking, past the breathing, past the beating of my heart, it will all fade away. But
as I mentioned at the end of the previous episode, unlike our other guests, Billy has not attended a Hogfish residency. But given his experience starting Broadway Barkada, which, like Hogfish, is dedicated to creating a platform for underrepresented voices, we knew he would bring a really interesting, important, and illuminating perspective to this podcast. So let's get started. Here's my conversation with Billy Bustamante. Thank you for listening. This is Hogfish Resonance. Wow, you were so still. I thought you froze for a second there.
I'm a photographer in my other life, so I know what it is to lean into the photo yoga-ness of it all.
Yeah, that was impressive. Well, I'm married to a photographer, and he uses an 8x10 camera, you know, like with the cape. Ooh. So I know what it's like to have to hold a pose for an excruciating amount of time.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Talk about a lost art form, like actual photography.
Yes, absolutely. Well, when you come this way sometime, I will introduce the two of you and you guys can geek out over photography together.
Oh, that sounds like a dream.
Absolutely. So speaking of coming to Maine, how do you know Matt and Edwin?
You know, I don't know Edwin, but I know Matthew. We met a couple of years ago, right at the height of the pandemic, actually. He brought me on board to teach for the Juilliard Summer Program, which I believe in 2021, summer 2021, was completely virtual. So we met and knew each other solely through Zoom screens for about a year and a half. The following year, when we did the Juilliard Summer Program again, we were in person down in Orlando, and it was actually like our first time like meeting.
Isn't that the funny thing?
Yeah. You're so tall.
Like, wow, you're not just a floating head. How cool.
It's so cool. I've never hugged so many people so hard.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. Yeah, how was the pandemic for you as a performer? So I'm a researcher and a writer, so most of my stuff I could do from home. But I really felt for my performer friends who weren't getting their fix on stage.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a great and complicated question to answer that I'm sure you'll get a different answer for every person you ask. I guess to contextualize, I identify as a theater artist more than a performer. When I have my theater maker hat on, sometimes that means I'm performing. Sometimes that means I'm directing or choreographing or educating or producing. So, you know, as we were going up, leading up to the pandemic, I would say like, pardon my dog.
That's fine. Dogs are welcome here.
Great. Leading up to the pandemic, it had been a very busy performing couple of years, which was lovely. But I always knew that the end goal was for me to exist in leadership artistically as a director or a choreographer and as an educator. So leading up to the pandemic, 2020 was going to be the first year that I was able to map out a full year of directing work. And I was very excited about it. And then, of course, we all know how that worked out.
Yeah. Wah, wah.
So, again, I firmly believe no wrong turns. When the pandemic happened, the professional acting studio that I teach for, the Jen Waldman Studio, made a very quick pivot to online and teaching pretty much like, I want to say April of 2020, we started teaching online, like, and revamped our programming, revamped our curriculum and our offerings to serve an online audience and experience. And that, I would say, honestly saved me as an artist. I was able to every day have a regular artistic practice with literally hundreds of other artists every month over Zoom. But to be able to gather in a space to feel a little less alone and to unpack that complicated question of who am I as an artist when I can't practice my art,
yeah,
was fascinating, complicated, but ultimately so healing and empowering. Because the lesson that I received, and I think so many other artists received through that space, was recognizing how they can be artists and are artists in so many ways that don't, that aren't limited to getting on stage and saying a speech or singing a song. I've saw so many artists unlock possibility in terms of how they can practice art and creativity in their relationships, in how they interacted with politics, how they cared for their and their partner's mental and physical health, how they told and recognized stories in every medium. So to me, that it was ultimately a very empowering thing.
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly a heightened time politically, emotionally, relationally.
Yeah.
So that's really fertile territory for any kind of artist to explore. Like, what does it mean when we're sort of in this existential moment and we are coming face to face with, with ourselves? It sounds like what you're talking about for you and perhaps for other people involved in the arts, it was maybe a very fertile time to explore some other parts of yourself and your work.
Yeah, I completely agree. Fertile is a great way to think about it because, you know, there was soil there always. And I think a lot of theater artists, particularly, especially ones that really got lost in the industrial slog leading up to the pandemic, forgot that that was our soil to till. And I feel like having this opportunity to focus on ourselves and recognizing that patch of earth is our own and something that we actually have control over and ownership of and responsibility for. I found it within myself the ability to like recognize so much more control that I had over my path as an artist that I did not think I had before.
Like what?
I recognized that there was like, you know, this seed of an artistic leader that leading up to the pandemic was not given enough water or fertilizer or sunlight. And the being able to step into these Zoom rooms and help lead artistic spaces really like fertilized that seed for me and like allowed it to blossom in a way that I don't think I would have had that opportunity in conventional ways pre-pandemic.
I love that phrase, discover this was our soil to till.
Yeah.
One of the themes that seem to be coming up a lot in these interviews is, and I know you are both, as you said, you're a theater artist, which sounds like is an umbrella term for the many, many things that you do. You're a director, you're an actor. So you've been on both sides of the stage.
Yeah.
A theme that I'm hearing a lot from performers that I interview, and one of the things that a lot of these folks have loved about getting involved with Hogfish and being part of their residential program is I don't know if I want to characterize it as a complaint, but a recognition that as performers performing at a certain level in New York City, let's say, they are often at the mercy of the director, of the producer, and they are sort of treated as doing objects as opposed to being beings. And getting into a situation like Hogfish, for example, where the focus is really like, how do we become beings yeah. together and let the performance just ooze naturally out of us?
That's thrilling.
Yeah. So what is your experience with that, you know, both as a director and as an actor? How have you experienced that either on either side of the stage?
You know, I guess I'll speak as a performer first, because I think while I consider directing and leadership to kind of always have been the end up, performing or helping push forward someone else's vision was my primary path to get there. So as a performer, and I'll speak specifically as a performer of color, as a Filipino, queer, Asian American performer in this country, that came with a great deal of complication. As a theater artist of my generation, I'm what I call the post-Broadway Saigon generation. Yeah. So a little historical context for everybody.
Now, I think I know what that means, but maybe you should explain to me in case I only think I know what it means.
The original Broadway production of Miss Saigon, which was a huge commercial success on Broadway in the 90s, right up until its closing in 2001, I'll say, created for the, in a new way, a demand and a place for Asian American theater artists to exist on Broadway and in the greater theatrical ecosystem. It created a trickle down of high profile regional productions of Miss Saigon that kept so many artists, including myself, employed. And it was the first time where so many artists of my generation who didn't get to perform, who were too young to perform in the original production, but grew up finally seeing themselves on stage represented in some way through like trailblazers like Lea Salonga, Kevin Gray, John Briones, and all countless other Asians that made their name through this platform. It was the first time where so many Asian artists of my generation just thought that there was a place for them. So they decided to major in this, study it, do it. So now, post Miss Saigon on Broadway, there is a brand new generation of literally thousands of Asian American theater artists who's paid $100,000 to get to learn how to do what they do, who had no place to go except for the occasional production of Miss Saigon, of The King and I, of these, you know, tried and true Asian shows, Asian vehicles, none of which actually authentically represented the culture that they were representing.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. It's there, but is it really representative?
Exactly. So, you know, not to discredit the value or the impact of these pieces. You know, the only times I've been able to ascend to the Broadway level of this business were in revivals of Miss Saigon and The King and I. Those were the two times I was granted access as a performer to what people consider to be the pinnacle, the apex of this industry.
Yeah.
With all that said, this idea of complication that I would say for me came about in like the late 20-teens, 2015 on, there was finally this conversation industry-wide about what representation means in media and entertainment. And it was the first time where, at least for me, the idea of representation didn't only mean visibility.
Interesting distinction.
I had just finished performing in the revival of The King and I, and I was currently performing in the revival of Miss Saigon. And in both cases, they were Asians. I'll speak specifically about Miss Saigon. With the revival of Miss Saigon, which was a wonderful time for me, I remember sitting in these rehearsal rooms and recognizing that I was here. My Asian body was here helping tell this Asian story, American story, mother story, primary like pillars of what this show is about. And no one who had any control over the telling of that story, none of the writers, leaders, creative team members represented any one of those perspectives.
Yeah.
And that was one of the biggest aha moments for, you know, where I could see the well-intentioned leaders falling into blind spots that they either wanted to cover up or wanted to disregard, and how that impacted the telling and the impact of our piece in a negative way. So for me, while I can look back at a production or an experience like Miss Saigon and know that it's literally helped me get to where I am today with no regrets, while I can with pride say that the revival of Miss Saigon that I participated in and that has subsequently toured the country is the most culturally authentic version of Miss Saigon in terms of representing Vietnamese culture with a certain level of integrity that has ever happened.
It got rewritten?
Certain parts got rewritten, yes, to further represent the Vietnamese culture with integrity, which I think is an achievement. And I can also recognize that it is still a piece riddled with problems, inconsistencies, and in my opinion, does not necessarily push the idea of representation with integrity forward for Asian Americans at this point in time. So given, you know, this idea of tension and complication in terms of performing as an Asian body in the theatrical complex of New York City, I was wrestling with the idea that, you know, I knew what kind of art I wanted to make. I knew what I want. I knew what my purpose was. And I was not able to practice my purpose as a individual in the performing rung of the ladder.
That has to be pretty gut-wrenching to spend your life working at your art only to find so few doors open to you and so few opportunities to manifest your talent in a public space.
Yeah, it's not a great feeling. It's not a great feeling. And I know I'm not the only person who experienced that feeling. And I'm not saying that's my only experience as an Asian American performer in the industry. There were amazing things like Soft Power at the Public, which I feel lucky enough to have participated in, Here Lies Love at the Public. So many, you know, my first 10 years as a working theater artist in New York were going to do Miss Saigon in some other state, coming back to New York and workshopping some exciting new show that actually was written by an Asian, which was thrilling.
Yeah.
It was also gut-wrenching to never see those pieces get any further than the developmental process because of the false narrative of what was commercially viable in the industry over that time. Cut to the pandemic and, you know, I remember having the realization and having to make the commitment that as I sat in these Zoom rooms with artists, with a lot of artists of color that I hadn't been able to gather with for, I think, ever in that capacity, I discovered that my art and our collective art form had the power to affect change in the world that I needed to take more responsibility for, especially looking at the world we were existing in. I had the further realization that if I was to affect any kind of change in the industry that I wanted to see take place in the industry, I wouldn't do it effectively from the performer rung of the ladder, at least within the system that exists at this moment. Yeah. So I had to make the commitment. Thanks, Kino. I made the commitment to focus on existing in positions of leadership going forward. So I consider myself to be very lucky and fortunate to have been able to do that ever since theater started coming back again. I've been working pretty consistently as a director, choreographer, and a teacher or educator through basically since we've started doing this again. And to see the ways theater has been made in this post-ish COVID era, seeing artists take a newfound sense of ownership of how their values and their personal mission, their aesthetic intersects with the art they get hired to do for someone else has been fascinating to me. The idea of how our values intersect with our product and our process is fascinating to me. And that's been the kind of mini mission exploratory science experiment that I consider myself to be on with every artistic process I enter, is how can we acknowledge a system that we still exist in and do what, at least personally for me, do what I can to challenge that system, find better ways to solve the dysfunction that exists, and find a way towards a better way of making, and then hopefully making something better in the process.
So you've just basically answered one of the questions driving this podcast, which is how do we create more inclusive stories to confront the challenges of our current era?
Ooh, it's like, Lord, I wish like there was an actual answer.
Well,
<right?
laughs> yeah, I think the multiplicity of answers is what's exciting and kind of the reason for this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How wonderful. And what an amazing mission for a podcast.
Oh, I I feel like my brain is getting expanded with every conversation, which is phenomenal. So much fun for me. I mean, for example, you making the distinction between visibility and representation. And what I think that is such an overlooked and essential distinction.
Yeah.
I think it's too easy for those of us in the, let's say, I don't know, the dominant culture, if that's the right way to phrase it.
Yeah, sure.
It's too easy to sort of for us to pat ourselves on the back and say, well, you know, hey, good for us. We represent this kind of person on stage and we represent this kind of person on stage. Well, the person is on stage. They are visible, but are they truly being represented? So I'm curious. My background is in anthropology.
Amazing.
And one of the things that's always tricky is that when you're talking about a cultural group, you want to recognize that there are characteristics within a particular cultural group that tend to be cohesive and glue the culture together. And it's sort of like, hey, I do that and I do that. And everybody can see themselves in this sort of like matrix of culture.
Yeah.
On the other hand, every single individual within that culture is an individual with their own response to that culture.
Yeah.
So how do you balance that? How does one, let's say you, or how would you like to see that being balanced out so that we are both getting representations of a culture and supporting a culture while also acknowledging the individuals existing within it as their own separate beings?
Oof, it's such a great question. And I think one of the primary like parts of the science experiment of making art in this age that we are still trying to find an answer to. Yeah. For me, things that I have found helpful in getting closer to an answer is making sure, again, recognizing that no culture is a monolith, recognizing that, you know, if you get 10 Filipinos together talking about a topic, you're going to get 10 very different opinions. making sure that the creators of the thing you are making as closely and as realistically as possible reflect that diversity of experience and that range of experience. I think one of the traps that the industry has fallen in is, you know, this whole idea of the diversity hire, right? Or the one representative at the table.
Yeah.
I agree. It's a failing of the industry when we think visibility is where representation stops, right? If we're telling a story about a certain culture, and yes, we're seeing the teller of that story, the conduit of that story, the person on stage speaking the words, represent that culture, but the words they are saying have been written by people who do not represent or understand or respect that culture. has representation been achieved? I think the answer is no. Now, let's say if the group of five of those storytellers who are creating the words that this person will say, if one of them is the lone, is the sole representative of that culture and has to shoulder the weight of the entire cultural experience on their back, is representation achieved? I say no. what I think, and this is my answer for today.
Understood.
Which I hope will change.
Yeah.
A standard shift. I think, making sure that as many versions of the experience we're trying to portray in a story are represented intersectionally within the creative room, to me, feels like what the new aim is, right? If I am telling a story of a Vietnamese mother, I am very interested in a Vietnamese son having a seat at the table, an Asian mother having a seat at the table, a white mother having a seat at the table, a person who represents a completely different other culture, but intersects with the identity in a different way. That way we can not just say, we can move beyond this is a certain story for a certain kind of person.
Yeah.
but then be able to graduate to the level of we're telling a story through a very specific lens that is meant to be universal and have an impact to every kind of person that interacts with it. To me, that seems like an exciting new goal to work towards. Oh, Lord, does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And I'm trying to choose between three different threads I want to tug on in what you just said. I think 3 to 18 different threads that I want to pull on. I'd like to go actually to a question that is near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
Connected to what you just said is I'll say this in multiple ways and you can choose your favorite and respond to it. What do you expect from, what do you hope from, what do you wish for, or what do you wish from an audience who's coming to see a piece like this that you're describing? Mm. I'm always interested in what does it mean to be an ethical storyteller, but almost more than that these days, I'm thinking about what does it mean to be an ethical audience member? And as an audience member myself, how would you like me to show up to a performance that you're involved with?
Oh, such a great question. Such a great question. I think for me, if I were to distill it down to one word, it would be curiosity.
Mm, yeah.
And then if I were to expand on that, add a second word to it is responsibility.
Yeah.
So I'm going to think about curiosity and then responsibility. When I think about practicing curiosity as an audience member, I would hope that audience members sit in an audience with other people and are able to recognize that they are no longer in front of their own screen consuming content that has been curated by an algorithm solely for their consumption.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And in that, you know, in the act of gathering with other people to receive a story that comes with the kind of unspoken social contract that some of what you see will be for you and some of what you see will not be for you. How wonderful. And in those moments where I am challenged as an audience member by a perspective, by an experience that does not align with my own, I am trying to, as an audience member, practice curiosity so that I can more effectively build a bridge of empathy to whatever that person on stage is experiencing that can help me leave the theater as a more well-rounded human. And I can only do that, an audience members can only do that if they remain curious and open to that possibility. So that is my hope. And I would say expectation that, you know, audience members come in and are ready to be curious and learn something new. Beyond that, this idea of responsibility, the idea that, again, you are no longer sitting in front of your own screen for your benefit and you are leaving the bubble of your own, content consumption experience, right? You are entering a gathering of people and you have a sense of control or a sense of an impact on how your presence in that room affects the storytelling experience for everyone as a collective. So, you know, I think it's an amazing thing. It's a muscle that I think has atrophied for us as a society over the past 10 years, but especially over the past 3 years, the idea that, you know, I can gather in a storytelling experience with other people in live space and get something that I'll never get from a screen, get something that I'll never get from a movie, but also recognize that the responsibility you have to make that experience as effective and as impactful for everyone involved. Sometimes that means being quiet. Sometimes that means, you know, unwrapping your hard candies at the beginning rather than the middle, right? And sometimes that means practicing opening your heart to someone sitting next to you who you may never cross paths with otherwise. But therein lies a really unique possibility to leave the theater changed.
I love both of those words. Responsibility, because I think we are trained to go to the theater, sit down, shut up-ish, and be passive observers of this thing that's unfolding. And what would it mean to be an active audience member? Mm. It doesn't necessarily mean interactive theater, but
Right.
But to what degree can we be interactive as we're observing these things that are unfolding in front of us? I think this idea of curiosity is a great active word. I mean, to be curious is one of the most fundamentally, essentially human things about us that I think we often forget in favor of being self-righteous or, you know, digging our feet in about something.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, as you say, it has become an atrophied muscle, the muscle of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you were to, because it has become so atrophied, when you say be curious, some people might go, well, what should I be curious about? Like, what would you give us some prompts in terms of what an audience might be curious about?
Oh, another, you are coming in with the questions today.
Yeah.
Someone has a degree. I think this is a list of questions that is going to continue to grow and evolve. For me, one of the things a script of questions that I kind of offer to my students and in turn myself is if I'm sitting consuming art as an audience member, and the something I'm seeing on stage, I'm going to call them like sparks of opportunity for curiosity, right? And for me, a spark of opportunity to practice being curious would, you know, an example of that would be when a character is on stage that I do not identify with in terms of my identity, when my identity does not intersect with the identity of a character on stage. Opportunity number one, because they are going to move through that story informed by a repertoire of experiences that I may not be able to relate with. So what I would hope would come next would be to examine how they move through this story, and you know, when those moments of friction and contrast come up, I practice asking the question, why would they? What got them to? And to me, that's a door that we can walk through and then, you know, really discover so much. The idea of asking why, right? Other things.
How about, I'm wondering what you think of this question. What would I do in that situation, or what would lead me to do what that character just did? Is that a good question, or is that too much projecting back on the self and you're taking away from like the character on stage?
I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think that's amazing, because it's what, you know, ultimately we are consuming art to have some kind of impact on ourselves, correct? So which I think like admonishing or like lessening the value of the self in the artistic equation, I think like comes with a level of guilt and judgment that I am ready to release.
Cool. Cool.
So I think those are great ways to do what I call like building the empathy bridge to someone different. And then being able to, in a roundabout way, find yourself in that person or in that story, in that experience. Yeah.
You hit on something so dystopian, which is the algorithm that rules our entertainment experience.
Yeah.
And, oy, mama.
Especially when you examine, you know, the Broadway ecosystem, what I'll call it. Because I think it's a living, breathing thing, which is comprised of multiple living, breathing organisms.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And, you know, I think we are seeing the ripple effects, the ramifications of an algorithm that has simplified itself to the lowest common denominator, knowing that the product needs to fulfill this lowest common denominator algorithm to be what we call financially or commercially viable.
Right. Right.
So again, like my hope is that is an algorithm that is continuing to be challenged, which I can see happening in small but impactful ways. But yeah, it's something we all have to work against. I personally believe.
And it sounds like one of the ways you have done this is by co-founding Broadway Barcada. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah.
Cool. Broadway Barcada.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And maybe you can say a little bit about what that is and the impetus behind that project.
Yeah. So Broadway Barcada is a theater organization comprised of Filipino theater artists all across the country. It was founded in 2009 by myself and my co-founders, Liz Casasola and Brian Jose. The three of us met doing what I call one of those like in-between Saigon experiences in this small off-Broadway musical called Imelda, a new musical, which was the first time for all of us there where we were a part of a Filipino story filled with Filipino people in the cast. And we were all gathering, telling a Filipino story and looking to our left and our right and saying like, oh, we don't have to be like Vietnamese or Thai or anything. Like, we get to be us.
Yeah.
And the electricity of that feeling combined with, you know, the feeling of community and family that you get whenever you get a room of Filipinos together, especially Filipino immigrants to New York City.
Yeah.
Was so powerful that once the show was done, we still felt the hunger for that feeling. So we found any reason to gather, create a performance opportunity for ourselves that became like kind of a multi-year offering of benefit programming, educational programming that gave us an opportunity to not only just be in community with each other, and something that we missed as transplants to New York City, but also gave us a safe space to practice skills that the industry would not let us exercise or develop in the current system.
Meaning basic, I don't mean basic, but your acting skills.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was a wonderfully unconventional way through that mission. You know, our flagship programming became an evening of love songs over Valentine's Day, where we again, like inadvertently, got to step into love-centered stories, like be like the center of a love story in our own like small 3 or 4 minute way, in a way that we don't get to do as Asian artists. The other flagship part of our programming was a choreography dance showcase at Alvin Ailey, where so many young Filipino wannabe aspiring choreographers got to have a process to practice their craft. Again, something that is rarely afforded to us. So for me, that again has been, the Broadway Barcada has been my New York City Filipino family. It's been a support system. It's been a community when I've longed for community.
I was actually having a conversation with Matt and Edwin about this recently. And I have no idea how one would research this, but I'm going to try, which is, if you have performers or art makers of any kind, because not just the performers, but the director as well, who are in a situation where they are really just feeling, and this is something that Edwin and Matt strive for with their Hogfish residencies, when you have a group of people who really feel like they are family and trusting of one another and relaxed and feel supported and feel seen, and they show up on stage with that vibe,
yeah,
that wave of generosity and cohesion kind of pushing them forward in their movements on the stage. How does that translate to the audience? Like, can the audience feel that kind of thing?
I think that's such an interesting idea. And yeah, I'm excited for the day where we can like brain map all of this stuff.
Right.
It really is uncharted territory. Like the things that happen inside us as humans, biologically, mentally, emotionally, as we are participating in the receipt of art, right? Knowing that I may never know legitimately in my lifetime the answer to that question. I think my answer for now is that yes, it does make a difference, because to me it all points to the making of the thing being healthier, being less traumatic, less harmful, and I firmly believe that the unnamed, invisible, energetic forces that surround ourselves when we are in a collective artistic process, that I do believe that that does get received by an audience in a certain way. I may never know scientifically.
right.
But I'm going to liken it to like the idea of if I need to sneeze, someone else needs to sneeze.
Exactly.
And I think there's a version of that happening when all of the audience members' heartbeats sync up in a way that studies have shown to happen. So I think that if artists are in a traumatic artistic making process, that does ripple into the audience experience. I may never know exactly how, but that is my belief. I also think that the quality, I guess I'll say quality of the artistic making process then branches out into how each of those artists goes forth and intersects with other processes and other pieces. And that is where I think the ecosystem of healthy storytelling, ethical storytelling, regenerative storytelling really has a chance to branch out in an exciting way.
Nice. So what does regeneration mean to you?
Ooh, to me, and I'm not a scientist.
That's okay. This is a personal opinion, an experiential opinion.
I think it's growth. I think it's the ability to grow and restore what has died or what has been lost. I think, when I look back at the past few years, we have that muscle of being in community with each other, gathering and, receiving the sustenance that you can only get by existing in live space with other people, sharing an experience. It feeds me in a way that nothing else can. And I think the ability to offer and receive that is something that I am constantly now trying to regenerate. How do I be with people again? Especially now when I try to exist in positions of leadership, how can I practice being with people, recognizing when I get vulnerable, when I get defensive, when I take things personally, or when I feel at my best and most in flow with my purpose and my process? It's all like a new technique that we are all, whether we know it or not, we're all practicing. It's funny, I've been a part of several artistic processes now where I've recognized for the first time those moments of free flow and recognizing those moments where like I am for the first time feeling like I feel safe, I feel open, I feel like held by my collaborators, and I feel like I am able to hold my collaborators, and we are all able to make something. Like it's the lightning flash of a second, but like that's a feeling that I've never felt before. And to me, that is a feeling that I will continue to try to chase and try to create for others.
Yes, exactly. And on that note, I just want to say a challenge and urging to audience members out there, go buy yourself a ticket to a show that has people on stage that do not represent you and see what you get out of that. And I'm going to make that a challenge for myself as well.
I think that's amazing. And I'll tell you, as someone who has had to do that for their entire life, it's great.
Yes, it is. Yes, exactly.
I have had to consume art that did not represent me for years. And as frustrating as that can be, like I have grown because I was forced to step outside of my experience and enter someone else's.
Right.
So anyone can do it.
Anyone can do it. Oh man, Billy, thank you so much for taking this time to come on and talk about all these really important issues. I know when I listen back to this, I'm going to kick myself because there's probably about like 80 questions I wish I'd asked you. and I hope you come to Maine sometime. We'd love to have you here. Come check out the castle.
I would love that. Thank you so much for the inspiring chat. And yeah, I'm such a fan of everything that Hogfish is seeking to create and accomplish. But like specifically, like, you know, yes, the gathering ingredient, the art making ingredient, but intersecting with nature is something we do not get to do in New York. And yeah. I do feel it's a primary ingredient, which I'm, you know, I'm so excited to see you continue to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. All right, there it is, my conversation with Billy Bustamante. Thank you, Billy. That was a fun one. And thank you all for listening. If you would like to learn more about Billy's work, head on over to his website at www.billybustamante.com. And as always, if you'd like more information about Hogfish, including its programs and offerings, go to www.hogfish.org. So it's hard to believe, but the next episode is going to be the last of this podcast series. It's been so amazing over these last six episodes to have the chance to speak with these talented, insightful theater makers. But now it's time to give some love and attention to some of the theater experiencers, audience members who give a reason for the arts to exist in the first place. Our final episode will highlight the voices of three Mainers who have attended various Hogfish performances. You'll hear them reflect upon what regeneration means to them and what they see as the value of attending a Hogfish event. Here's a brief clip from each of the three.
I've been to two events, both wonderful. The diversity in these performances were not only diverse art forms, but diverse people. And all of that opens opportunity for adventure, really, finding out how somebody else thinks, opening a new window in a new experience.
For me, it was very meaningful because of the physical action of describing what is to fit in. And you have to see the performance to understand every time that she jumped inside a dress. I felt myself jumping into a new community, into a new society. How I'm going to fit in. As a migrant.
You know, we have a lot of institutions in New England, like really old institutions in New England that are wonderful. They're sort of edifices to the craft, but we don't have a lot of new up and coming companies yet, and certainly not in Maine. So I was really thrilled to see sort of a new artistic energy come into the playing field in Maine.
So please do tune in for that. In the meantime, be well, everyone. This is Hogfish Resonance.